Welcome, gentle listeners, to the Daily Nightly, a Jane Austen journey, where we'll be reading the collective works of Jane Austen and exploring her influence in pop culture. We are your humble servants. I am Annie.
And I am Jessie.
And today we are talking about chapters 21 through 25 of Jane Austen's Mansfield Park. Hi, Jessie.
Hey, Annie. These are some good chapters.
Hey, these are some good chapters. A lot of things happened, but also didn't happen, which I guess is most of Jane Austen, if we're being honest.
A lot of like interpersonal drama rather than plot points, but I was really into it. I felt like I was watching or like watching unfold like a 90s rom-com.
Yeah. There's a lot of things that made me change what I expected or what I hoped for in the rest of the story. So I can't wait to dig into all of that with you.
Yes, no, me too.
Before we get into that though, what are you paying attention to right now, Jessie?
Oh gosh, I'm going to try not to go too overboard on this, but I've been really lucky since we last spoke to have read a lot of amazing books. Probably one of my most, I know, I've been like very loud about it, but probably one of my most anticipated of the year was Rule of Wolves by Leigh Bardugo, and that came out March 30th, and I finished it. Does March have 31 days or 30 days?
31 days.
Okay. Because I counted it as a book I read for March because I read it in like one day and it's over 500 pages and I can't believe I did it, but it was just fantastic. This is billed as the last book in the Grishaverse that started with the Shadow and Bone trilogy, the Netflix show of which is coming out on April 23rd. And it's the second book in the King of Scars duology. And this book basically blew my mind. While the Shadow and Bone trilogy is just okay for me and the Crows duology that comes after sequentially are some of my favorite books that I've ever read. I didn't love King of Scars, but it ends on a really big cliffhanger, and I was really looking forward to seeing the fallout, like what would happen. I literally cannot say anything about this book plot-wise because it would all be a huge spoiler, but it really gave me like everything I would want, like literally everything. Like I was buddy reading it with a couple people that we know, Corinne and Tasia of the Act YA Age podcast. And we were both just like screaming at each other via instant message, just like, oh my God, like, can you believe this happened? Like, just like screaming. It was like very fun reading experience. It has a very satisfactory ending if you want to consider it a final book in the Grishaverse. However, she definitely keeps the door open to write more. The last line of this book is spectacular. Like, I gasped out loud. It's probably my favorite last line of any book I've ever read. So I know it's a lot of information considering I didn't give you like one part of the plot, but I don't want to spoil anything. But you should definitely continue reading because I know you started the Shadow and Bone trilogy, Annie.
Yes, finally.
The books get better as they go on, and this is a really like fun way to cap it off. Like all your faves come back. It's really fun. I can't say anything about it, but I'm bursting. I like really want to. So
okay, I've got to just catch up then, I guess.
And then another book that sort of changed my life was The Intimacy Experiment by Rosie Dinan. I don't remember if I talked on the pod with you, Annie, about the book The Roommate. I think I read it earlier this year. It's a fun romance. It's also by Rosie Dinan. And it's about a young woman who moves across country only to find out her new roommate is a famous porn star. And they fall in love. And this is a sequel of sorts. It's more like an in-universe type deal, but it focuses on a character from The Roommate named Naomi Grant. Naomi is a badass heroine who I adored, and when she gets hired to lead a seminar on relationships in order to help save a dwindling synagogue, she strikes up a connection with the hot rabbi, Ethan Cohen.
Ooh.
I know. This book was super hot, super sexy, and super wonderful, and I absolutely adored it. It also made me think a lot about, you know, I've been trying to really consciously make a decision to diversify my bookshelf and make sure that I'm reading books that reflect different experiences and a lot of books that are considered own voices books, where the people writing those books are a part of the community that they're writing about. And to be honest, it never really occurred to me to seek out Jewish own voices books, and I honestly didn't even know they existed outside of books about the Holocaust pretty much. And this book really opened my eyes to this whole other, you know, world where, you know, I can see my own upbringing reflected and highlighted in a joyous way, not just about like the pain of World War II. And so I'm gonna like continue seeking out these books and seeking out those authors. And I think it's just a really another reason to support own voices books and seek them out and in, you know, different voices than your own and different experiences, but also just how special it is to find an own voice book that speaks to you personally. So anyway, that was my journey through this book. Aww. That's just really a sexy romance.
No, that's so lovely. Oh, now I have to find up this one quote. So, I mean, that's been such a huge topic right now with diversity and voices and everything like that in books. So it's really nice that you get to have that feeling too. Thankfully, just as an Asian American second generation immigrant living in this country, it has still not always been the easiest, but it has been, like you said, a joyous experience to find books where you see yourself and your experience as opposed to just the torture porn of it all. And I think we both can see that we've been conditioned to see a lot of those stories is through the filter of primarily like a white male patriarchal American Western gaze, which, you know, I think we've both been making an effort to break out of. So I'm really excited that you've gotten that moment. And speaking of white men, there's this one quote that I really like and I think about sometimes from The History Boys by Alan Bennett. And one of the teachers, the main teacher, he says, you know, the best moments in reading are when you come across something, a thought, a feeling, a way of looking at things, which you had thought special and particular to you. And now here it is, set down by someone else, a person you have never met, someone even who is long dead. And it is as if a hand has come out and taken yours. And that is one of the best moments, I feel like, when you're reading a book.
Oh, I love that.
Isn't it wonderful?
It's a great quote.
Even when it's so completely opposite to anything that you experience, there's this moment where you're like, I am not the only person. Yeah, big fan of books encouraging empathy and connection in this world.
Yeah, and this one also has like very hot sex in it too. So,
which is something I hope most of us who want that in our lives can also relate to.
That is true. But yeah. Yeah. Both of Rosie Donnan's books are great. You should check them out even if you aren't Jewish. There's a lot of like really interesting factoids in there and things that like anybody would like, I think, to read. But it was an interesting experience for me personally. But yeah, check it out. I think you'd like it too, Annie.
Oh, almost definitely. You have yet to let me down with any of your recommendations.
I get way too excited.
No such thing as too excited. No. Too excited is just excited enough. That's appropriate.
Annie, what are you reading?
So like you said, I did start the Grishaverse books. I've only read one. It's Shadow and Bone, which I did enjoy. A huge part of it is because we're doing like a little book club. And I know you're a big fan of the overall Grishaverse. I know this trilogy in particular is not your favorite of the bunch, especially this book. And yeah, I can totally see why. It's a good, solid intro into a world. And I did enjoy that it wasn't completely cookie cutter of the chosen one kind of narrative and the idea of who you can trust. Interestingly enough, I started reading a different book first, a book called Wicked Saints by Emily Duncan.
Oi.
Yeah. I made it 2 chapters in, and then I remembered that we were going to talk about Shadow and Bone for book club, so I kind of did a little skirt over back to Shadow and Bone, which was fine, whatever. Wicked Saints didn't seem like it was too on demand at the library. And weirdly, the so many common things in one that I saw in the other, it was actually really disorienting. So much, there's a lot of like Slavic influence in both books. And someone actually did tell me that there are lots of reviews of Wicked Saints that points out, that refers to it as like a Grishaverse fanfic, basically. But since then, a lot has come out about Emily Duncan and her being a terrible anti-Semitic racist human who has targeted and bullied other authors, particularly Asian American ones. She's got some anti-Semitic plot points in her books, it turns out, things that she was aware of when she put it in the books. So I think I ended up on the better end of things. And a friend of mine actually works on her marketing, who is Asian and Jewish. So that's super awesome. More diversity in publishing. Thank you very much.
It's one of those things that, you know, we would never know if we were just kind of casual readers that came out on Book YA Twitter and then rightfully exploded and got everyone's notice. So I, you know, suffice to say, this is a Jane Austen podcast, but we will not be covering the books of Emily Duncan on this podcast.
Yes. If you have enjoyed and read any of the books and didn't know any of this, don't feel bad, but I hope that you take this knowledge and do something with it and help support, along with us, the diversity of voices and different perspectives in publishing, because you know what? There's just too much wonderfulness in the world to spend it on bullies and racists.
And it's worth pointing out that Rin Chupeco is the one that spoke of this first, I believe, on mm-hmm. book Twitter and really put themselves out there in order to do this and risk their career. So their book, The Bone Witch, is going up on my TBR because I want to support them. And the trolls have already come out and started one-starring all of their books. So The Bone Witch, check it out.
Yeah. What else? Oh, so I also was loaned these wonderful little books that I took in. One is called Your Illustrated Guide to Becoming One with the Universe by Yumi Sakugawa and Aloha by Mako. They're both illustrated book, you can probably guess from the name. The first one is kind of just a meditative connecting with the universe kind of thing. And I'm not the most new agey person ever, but it is a very beautiful, beautifully illustrated, very meditative kind of read. Whether you're taking it more literally or not, it was just an enjoyable, fairly fast read. I actually forced myself to take in a chapter a day or every other day just to let it sit. And I still get to enjoy the lovely imagery. And Aloha, Mako is, what's her actual name? Hold on. She is an Uruguayan cartoonist. And the book is in Spanish, but the text is fairly sparse. And it's a short book. It's a quick read. But it's just like a really beautifully illustrated book also of this girl who just falls into a dreamland. And it plays with the format of comic strips in the windows and everything. And it's very surreal in a fun, creative kind of way. And there's this little moment, this little scene where she just meets a Grim Reaper, and it's really cute, where she offers him coffee and he's just like, thanks for not being scared. And she's like, scared? I thought that was just a costume. It's just lovely. So Aloha by Mako. If you need translations like me, it's very few things that you need to actually translate, and Google is your friend. Also, another book club type situation, reading The Fellowship of the Ring currently. I'm not that far in, but I am also enjoying it, especially once I got past all the forewords and explanations about different editions, which I don't think I needed to read. So I have all that to look forward to.
Awesome. No, it sounds like that's a pretty good book, group of books to chew on, as well as in different sort of mediums. Would you call The Illustrated Guide a graphic novel?
I think Illustrated Guide's a pretty good call for it, because it's not long. It's definitely shorter than like a novella type situation. It doesn't have a narrative, but it is it isn't a strict guide. But I think the actual act of reading it and going through it and admiring the pictures and everything and flipping back and forth is a really thoughtful process in and of itself. So
awesome. That sounds really cool.
Yeah. Trying to mix it up this year, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, that's... Yeah, I love the idea of reading like one chapter before you go to sleep, or like one chapter. I think for a lot of books that are more like vignette style, that's like a really good way to make sure that it sinks in versus like binge reading, which is what I do a lot of the time.
I am a little bit of the same way. You are very good at taking in a lot of things at once. I will do big chunks at a time, which is sometimes how books get lost. Oh, I almost forgot. I bought as a gift for my little 5-year-old godson, who is a wonderful little boy that I've only gotten to see twice in the past year of, you know, world end times. But for his 5th birthday, I was really excited to get him these 3 books by, of all people, comedian Michael Ian Black, who I have a slight beef with because he was not super nice to me when I met him in college when he performed there. But I've slightly warmed up to him. He's written a bunch of children's books. These 3 in particular, the I Am series or I'm series, which is for both of his kids, but he was sort of particularly thinking of his son when he wrote them. They're called I'm Bored, I'm Worried, I'm Sad. And they're really just feelings books and just being, you know, with how creative and fun kids are, or like how it's okay to be worried about things and how to kind of like maybe chill a little bit about when you're feeling worried, or like if you're sad, how, you know, like sometimes you're just sad and people are still going to love you and it's okay, that kind of thing. So I would really recommend that for if you're looking for some books for some younger kids. They're adorable. They're starring a flamingo, a little girl, and a potato.
Okay.
My godson's parents are both teachers and they seem to enjoy it too. So big recommendation.
Oh, I love that. We should definitely recommend more middle grade and young children books. So,
well, especially because you're catching up at that time where your little one is going to be needing her own collection.
Oh gosh, I was reading her like Baby's Guide to the Constitution, and I had to I had to editorialize a lot. I was like, this isn't exactly right, but okay.
Tell me that your mom's a lawyer without telling me your mom's a lawyer. Okay, so Mansfield Park. So before we get into the summary of chapters 21 through 25, previously on Days of Our Mansfield Park, our favorite young folk of Mansfield are still busy at work on their play. Fanny still refuses to be an active part of the play despite helping everyone practice their lines and being useful. To her surprise and disdain, Edmund agrees to be in the play too and ends up playing Mary Crawford's love interest. Oh, how did this happen? Fanny tries not to be too jealous, but she is sought out by both Mary and Edmund to help them practice their big love scene, which proves too much for Fanny to handle. Unfortunately, before our thespians can do their big rehearsal, Sir Thomas returns from Antigua to pour cold water over the whole endeavor. Sir T ruins all the fun and shuts down production, probably for the best, really. Poor Mariah Bertram waits for Henry Crawford to declare his undying love to her, and when he doesn't, in fact, he runs very far away, she resigns herself to being depressed. Her sister Julia is relieved to be rid of Henry, and she and Mary reconcile. All right.
Summary time.
What did we read this week? Jesse.
Well, Annie, now that Sir Thomas is back, Mansfield is a much quieter place. Edmund is still not over his infatuation of, Mary Crawford, much to Fanny's dismay. Sir Thomas is concerned about Mariah and her marriage to the idiot Rushworth, and it's obvious to everyone that Mariah is not very into him. Sir Thomas offers Mariah an out, telling her he will break off the engagement for her. However, Mariah is still bitter over Henry ghosting her, so she assures him that she does want to marry Rushworth. The couple get married and leave for Brighton, taking Julia with them. Now that both Bertram daughters are gone, Fanny is the hot commodity at Mansfield. Lady Bertram has become fond of her and requires her presence, even their uncle enjoys her company. Fanny also becomes the favorite at the Grants' home, too, where Mary Crawford is staying. One rainy day, Fanny has to stay over and becomes friendly with Mary. Mary, desperate for female companionship, starts dropping hints as to her feelings for Edmund, and Fanny is conflicted and keeps quiet. Mary, though interested in Edmund, keeps making thoughtless and disparaging comments about wealth and Edmund's choice in careers. One day, Fanny's invited to dine at the Grants along with Edmund. Mrs. Norris and Lady Bertram are stunned, but Sir Thomas tells Fanny to accept. Mrs. Norris, of course, ruins all of Fanny's happiness by lecturing Fanny about her real place in the family and tries to prevent Sir Thomas from sending the carriage for her. Fanny and I know, she's just like the worst. To Fanny and Edmund's surprise, Henry Crawford is at dinner as well. Henry annoys Fanny by making some rather rude comments about Mariah and Julia as well as Sir Thomas for stopping the play. Fanny impresses Henry by shutting him down, because he's that kind of guy. Later, Henry and Mary discuss Edmund's prospects as a younger son and that he's uninterested in both wealth and fashion, even as Mary tries to pry. The day after the big dinner, Henry announces to his sister Mary that he'll be staying in Mansfield for a while. His entertainment will be to make Fanny fall in love with him. Mary tries to dissuade him and tells him that while Fanny is pretty, she only appears so attractive because Mariah and Julia are not around. Henry explains to her that the entire challenge is because Fanny isn't interested in him. Henry starts wooing Fanny, and then a letter arrives that Fanny's beloved brother, William, who's in the Navy, will soon be in England. Sir Thomas has invited him to spend the holidays at Mansfield. Henry notes that Fanny's intense devotion to her brother and uses it to his advantage. William shows up, is a fine young man, and impresses all who meet him with tales of his adventures at sea. Henry is moved by Fanny's delight and love of her brother and decides that he's genuinely in love with her. Sir Thomas notices Henry's interest in Fanny and resolves to support the match. At a dinner party at the Grants, Henry begins to woo Fanny in earnest, sitting next to her and, you know, teaching her how to play cards. Edmund and Mary's relationship, however, takes another turn for the worse because at the dinner party, Henry suggests that improvements could be made to Edmund's parsonages at Thornton Lacey. Edmund resists, citing practicality and expense, and claims he likes the place as it is. Mary is disappointed, especially when Edmund says he will occupy the personage himself and not rent it to Henry. Fanny's also disappointed because this means she will no longer see Edmund every day. William and Fanny have heart to heart where he tells her that he's disappointed he hasn't been made lieutenant yet and talks of how much he will miss her. He says he wishes he could dance with her and asks Sir Thomas if Fanny's a good dancer. Sir Thomas doesn't know and Henry steps in to try to flatter her. Sir Thomas then gets the good idea that he'll throw a ball for William and Fanny. And you know how much we love balls over here.
Everything happens at a ball.
Everything happens at a ball.
That in fields.
I was like, oh my god, they're going to have a ball. It's like in Cinderella, the prince is having a ball.
Okay, yeah, everything is happening. It's totally cool. It's totally fine. Because we really haven't had a good ball yet, have we?
No, we haven't. And that is not great.
We're halfway through the book and there hasn't been a ball. What have we been doing this whole time?
Well, there was almost a play. True. Almost.
Oh my goodness. We almost had a play and not a ball.
Ugh. I know. But now we get a play. We get half a play and a ball. So we get all the good things.
Wow. So we all kind of thought that things were going to be kind of dire once Sir Thomas came back. But he's kind of been an interesting wrench in the whole machinery that I did not expect. How about you?
Yeah. You know, it's been really one of the interesting things about this book that's pretty different than the other Jane Austen books we've covered is that the characters, every time I like start disliking a character, they'll do something like really nice with like, mm-hmm. and I'll just be like, wait a minute, I thought I was supposed to like this character. So everyone's just so much more nuanced. And I know we've talked about this before, but it just continually surprises me how characters that I think are pegged one way will do something like, I mean, sometimes it's selfishly nice, but it's still nice. And Sir Thomas, like, all of a sudden he likes Fanny, wants her around. I mean, she's still, like, scared of him, but she's scared of everyone.
I mean, I think with the exception of Mrs. Norris, who continues to be the worst, most abusive person alive.
I really hate her.
She's the worst. She's not even funny.
Yeah.
It's terrible. I think it's totally fine that sometimes there are some selfish, lightly selfish ulterior motives going on. You know, it's like in the great classical musical of our times, Avenue Q, helping others is also helping yourself.
Great. It's true, though.
Gotta pull it in there. The Lopez's, man. It is amazing.
I know. I didn't expect to, like, to come out of this being like, maybe Sir Bertram isn't that bad. And he just, like, really missed his family when he was abroad. And it's just, you know, he wants to, like, his insular family together. Like, is that so wrong to not want to, like, hang out with all these other people all the time?
Yeah. And there's like a sense of propriety and everything, which can be a bit snobbish. But I can also kind of see how Edmund came from this guy, like this guy who's all about modesty and propriety and everything, but still seemingly not completely unaware, not super cold and mean and horrible. Like, all of Fanny's anxiety about him still makes me think there's something not amazing about him. Speaking of amazing, he probably has had his moments, too. And Fanny even points out, because everyone's just like, well, things are so somber now. And Fanny says, you know, as well as I can recollect, it was always much the same. There was never much laughing in his presence. Or if there is any difference, it is not much. It is not more, I think, than such an absence has a tendency to produce at first. So I forget where I was going with this.
It's funny that the other Thomas Bertram is, like, not around anymore. And his, like, only point in the plot is just to be, like, the older son to Edmund's. So Edmund's, like, the younger son.
Yeah. I mean, I guess as far as characters who are around and not super nuanced, Sir Thomas. Or Tom.
Thomas Jr. Tom. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's kind of funny that we are getting more of Sir Thomas than we are getting Tom, who just shows up, brings Yates, causes trouble, and then disappears again.
But yeah, I mean, I think when these chapters open, everyone's sort of a little bit sad. But then when chapter 21 ends, like, it's a very quick turnaround. Like, everyone's really sad, but then there's, like, a wedding, like, very quickly. Which I did not anticipate at all, that Mariah would marry Mr. Rushworth. I thought she'd sort of blow her chance or want to get out of it. So I was shocked by the events of just, like, this first chapter. I mean, did you think they were going to get married?
I wasn't really sure. Like, I definitely thought there was going to be some, like, big scandal that was going to upturn everything that we held near and dear at Mansfield Park. So yeah, no, I think I was pretty surprised too. Possibly more surprising, though, was when Sir Thomas was just like, I don't think you like your husband very much. That was probably more striking, actually, to me. When he's just like, I don't think my daughter's really happy. If you just say the word, and as advantageous as this wedding would be, as this marriage would be, it's not worth the cost of your happiness. And while probably he said it in the way where he's just like, but seriously, you should marry him. The fact that he even does it to begin with is so weird. That whole interaction was really confusing for me. I don't know if you had the same feeling, but, like, the fact that Mariah's just like, no, of course I want to marry him. My love is super certain, and I'm guaranteed my happiness, and blah, blah, blah. I spent, the rest of the page being like, but why? And later on, we learned that the why is because of spite.
Yeah, well.
Which made me like Mariah so much.
I know. It was really fast. I was shocked when he, like, of all people to give Mariah an out, it was Sir Thomas. I was really surprised by it. I read some notes here that there was sort of, at this time, there was a new attitude toward relationships, and that previously marriages along the upper classes had been mostly business arrangements. In the early 19th century, there was a new interest in marriages as companionable relationships, that the men and women should not only financially but also spiritually help one another. And the discussion notes say that because Sir Thomas had taken this harrowing trip, that it taught him the importance about family and relationships, and he doesn't want to see his daughter make a mistake. And we also do know, like, the book starts off letting us know that Lady Bertram and Sir Thomas had a love match that was also financially advantageous. So I guess it's not totally out of the blue necessarily that Sir Thomas would be conscientious enough to think about his daughter's feelings, even though, you know, we know this family might be needing some money and, you know, Rushworth has all this money. But at the same time, when it comes up, it's incredibly surprising. And also surprising that Mariah says yes, but it seems like everybody's kind of cool with it. She's like, well, I'll just be rich. Like, who cares that he's an idiot?
Yeah, like, I think he was actually, I got the impression he was relieved that she's like, yeah, of course I want to marry that guy. And just kind of like comforted himself with the fact that, like, well, she'll have money, she'll be taken care of, and if she's not that happy with him, that means, you know, he's also close enough that she could still come and visit more often and spend time with her family.
Yeah, there's some really great quotes here. I thought, you know, a well-disposed young woman who did not marry for love was in general but the more attached to her own family, and if she could dispense with seeing her husband a leading shining character, there would certainly be everything else in her favor. So it reflects back on a lot of what we've been saying about Austen, that a lot of all of her female characters so far that we've read that you're rooting for have ended up in lovely for love relationships, but also have been relatively financially advantageous. But we've also seen, you know, Charlotte Lucas marrying Mr. Collins, not for love, but to be settled. So even though we've seen all these love matches, we also see these, not conniving, but just realistic matches as well. And so it's not, so even though it is surprising the way it goes down here and how quickly it wraps up, at the same time, it also fits in Austen's philosophy on marriage, that sometimes a woman's going to marry just to have a lot of money, and that's totally fine and acceptable because this is all a woman really could do at this time in order to get power.
Yeah. And it is an interesting parallel to Miss Crawford, who just very seems intent on being well off. But at the same time, still being tempted by this guy that she's super into and can't seem to let go of.
Oh, yeah. There's so many different dynamics going on. It's fascinating to watch them all unfold and change. Like, every time we start a new grouping of chapters, I feel like the dynamics are shifting in different ways that feel so much different than from the way Sense and Sensibility and Pride and Prejudice unfolded. Like, those felt more like, yeah, Lizzie goes back and forth on Darcy, but it feels more of like a point A to point B to point C, whereas this one is just like all over the place. Like, let's have a play. Well, the play doesn't happen. This person's in love with this person. This person's in love with, like, people decide that they're in love really quickly. And if I didn't know that we're supposed, like, Edmund and Fanny are supposed to end up together, I would honestly be a little bit lost in these chapters. Like, who am I even rooting for? Like, I wanted Mariah to be happy. Like, is she? I think she's happy now. Like,
yeah. Like, part of me wants to be like, do we feel like Mariah kind of gets what she deserves or whatever for being in that situation where she was like flirting with this guy that she knew her brother was into, but also she was like flirting with him too because she genuinely was attracted to him and was kind of neglecting her actual fiance that she was marrying out of convenience. But at the same time, it is kind of just what she wants. She wants to be well off. She's helped. It like ends the conflict between her and her sisters. She like played with the idea of the dangerous choice, but then it's just like, you know what? Let it go. I'm fine. And doing just what is like most practical for her and her family, which is not a romantic idea. It's not an ideal situation really, but it's realistically, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and the way the chapter ends is her and Julia, like, get to go off to this lovely beach town of Brighton, which sounds, like, amazing, like, lovely. I mean, we've talked about Brighton before in the concept of Pride and Prejudice. Like, Lydia gets to go to Brighton. So
finally, someone gets to go to Brighton.
For England, that's like a beach vacation. So they're all, like, Rushworth has all this money to, like, have a beautiful house. And, you know, Julie gets to go with and have, like, a lovely time. So, yeah, Rushworth is, you know, sort of ignorant and not great. But, you know, Mariah is not exactly, you know, having horrible time, this lovely, like, beach time with her sister. But you do get a sense of what Jane feels about it, because at the very end, they talked about how Fanny misses them, and their mother misses them, and it says, even their mother missed them, and how much more their tender-hearted cousin, who wandered about the house and thought of them and felt for them with a degree of affectionate regret, which they had never done much to deserve. So Austin sort of leaves you with, yeah, they're, like, having a great time off together, but now they're out of the picture, and remember, Fanny's great, Fanny cares about them, and they didn't really deserve it. Remember, they suck a little bit.
They suck a little bit, but if someone like Fanny is gonna feel some affection for them, then maybe not too bad. Things are fine.
And now Fanny's like the hot commodity of Mansfield Park. Everyone wants to spend time with her.
Yeah, everyone. It's so weird, and to the point where she's just like really confused. Not only does Mary want to hang out with her, to the point where Mary even offers her dry clothes, which does make Fanny feel indebted. And like she's like, I guess I do have to just stay now and be nice about it instead of a big giant anxious ball that runs away.
I mean, she's like trapped at their house in the rain, and she keeps being like, looks like the rain has let up. And Mary's like, oh, no, you have to sit here and wait till we're 100% sure that it won't rain anymore. That's how like bored Mary is. She's like, you are not to leave. And Fanny's like, but it's shit. No, you are not to leave this house.
I don't trust those clouds. Don't trust those clouds.
And Fanny's like, too nice to say anything. Like, how many times have you been like stuck at a party and you're like, how can I leave? I can't leave.
Like, it's a little frustrating, a little angering to me that suddenly now there's no, the Bertram girls aren't there. And there's like no other options. Everyone's just like, so Fanny, tell me about everything. And at the same time, there's still, you know, Fanny starts feeling like at least relaxed enough to talk about how amazing nature is and stuff. And Mary's just kind of like, meh.
Mary just wants to talk about herself and Edmund and complain about Edmund. And Fanny's just like so uncomfortable.
Which, I mean, I hate that I keep trying to defend Mary, but
no, I like Mary.
I like her so much.
I like
even
her
when
so
she's
much.
Really headstrong and tunnel visioned. She's great.
Oh, she keeps talking about how she like wishes Edmund, you know. She has some like his, like really, really funny lines where she talks about how calling him like what did she say?
They're talking about, like, Edmund Bertram.
Mr. Edmund Bertram. And she says something like, well, if he was called Lord Bertram, that'd be different, or Lord Edmund Bertram. It's very funny. And she just like keeps trying. But like, I've actually had these conversations with people about like men that I've dated. So I just feel like if I'm going to indict Mary for this, then I have to put myself on trial too.
That was a funny moment because like she and Fanny started getting into like a weird, unimportant debate about what they prefer to call Edmund and why it's better in one way. It's so silly and low-key competitive. And I don't think that Mary's somewhat perceptive, it seems, but I don't know if she fully understands like why they're getting into this debate. I mean, Fanny probably doesn't even realize either. She's just probably like, I have to say a thing because it's about Edmund. No, I really do enjoy Mary. She's so much fun. And I don't think that she necessarily is just being nice to Mary to Fanny out of convenience. She does seem to like really enjoy her company, even if it's just not necessarily they're going to be the best of friends and they're meant, you know, MFEO, BFF kind of thing. Like she just seemed to enjoy having someone listen to her play who it was new to it and didn't have complaints. She's just like, oh, but of course she still has to bring it back to Edmund of like, by the way, this is his favorite song. Please enjoy.
Yeah, it is interesting, the dynamic, because Fanny doesn't consciously realize that she is the hots for Edmund. She just thinks she's like defending him as her like beloved cousin. And Mary is not at all threatened by Fanny.
No, which is kind of great.
That's true. No, yeah. And I do enjoy their, like, friendship. And there's, like, Edmund is such, like, a black box for me in some ways. Like, I just really, I can't, like, get a handle on him and, like, whether he's worth Fanny. I think there's like a creepy quote that I think we both like highlighted in here in the first chapter that we read in chapter 21, where he goes, "Your uncle thinks you're very pretty, dear Fanny. Anybody but myself would have made something more of it, and anybody but you would resent that you had been thought very pretty before." So he like calls her like pretty in like a very condescending way, and specifically calls out the fact that like he doesn't think she's that pretty, but like everyone else does.
Yeah.
And then he thinks to himself about the friendship between Fanny and Mary, that a friendship between the two is so very dear to him was exactly what he could have wished. He did not by any means consider Fanny as the only or even as the greater gainer by such friendship. So he thinks to himself that, you know, Mary is probably improving herself because she's friends with Fanny. I can tell that he has like a fondness for her, but there's some like condescending looks that he gives her and condescending things that he says. And even when he calls her pretty, he like does it in a, like Jane calls it, a brotherly way, and it's very mm-hmm. like weird. And I just don't have a handle on like what he's thinking.
Yeah, because when one he says that no one ever gets compliments out of him, not even Fanny, and then proceeds to sort of compliment her looks through the voice or whatever perspective of her, of his father. Super weird.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like complimenting her but not actually. And I did want to like talk about this with you because he is mm-hmm. so brotherly, and he almost like treats her like the wounded dove. And I'm just like wondering, do I actually ship him still? Like, do I want them to end up? Because on the one hand, he does have like real true kindness and like a brotherly affection to her. He literally never sees her in any other kind of way. He acknowledges that she's beautiful, even if he doesn't like do it directly. But like you said, does he deserve her? Do we really want someone who looks down on her, even if it's in a well-intentioned, charitable kind of way? Or is it just, what's the word I want to say? Paternalistic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm very unimpressed with Edmund in a lot of ways. I mean, there's the conversation that they have in, I think, chapter 22, where he's Mary's trying to get out of him. I mean, she's trying to pry. She's trying to like get him to admit that he wants to be wealthy. And it's just like a very, it basically ends with Mary being very disappointed because Edmund refuses to say that he wants to be rich. He just says like, "I don't want to be poor." And he knows what Mary wants. Like, he knows what she's fishing for, but he just refuses to back down because those are his convictions, which speaks well to his character. And if he really, really loved Mary, wouldn't he want to give her what she wants? So it's interesting that he does push back on her as much as he does, because as much as he's infatuated with her and seems to be into her, if he really wanted her, he knows how to get her, and he's just refusing to play those games. So doesn't that mean that he doesn't really like Mary and maybe somewhat more worthy of Fanny? I don't know. It's just he's very – I can't get a good enough read on him. And right now I wouldn't say that Fanny – like, he deserves Fanny. If this is the end game, right now he's not at Mr. Darcy or any of my favorite love interests. I'm like totally blanking. All I can think of is Alan Rickman. Colonel Brandon.
The best. Yeah, no, he's willing. There's a lack of willing to compromise his so-called integrity on one hand for Mary, whom he clearly feels something for. But at the same time, what's there for Fanny, who doesn't seem to have any ideation of her future or what she wants? All she knows is that she seems to have this loyalty and attraction of some level to Edmund, and almost possessiveness. Do we want her to be attracted to someone just because he seems to be her hero and is always saving her?
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a moment in this book that I find fascinating. Forgive me for jumping ahead, because I really do like how we're going through it chronologically, but I do want to point it out because there's a moment where Jane editorializes. I think we talked about this, like, it doesn't happen a lot, where Jane uses the first person to talk about herself and, like, inserts herself in the conversation. And it's a moment in chapter 24, so I'm jumping ahead quite a bit. But she's speaking about, which I really want to get into the whole Henry situation, but she's talking about Henry being really attentive to Fanny. And it says, "For although they're doubtless as such unconquerable young ladies of 18, or one should not read about them, as are never to be persuaded to love against their judgment. For all the talent, manner, attention, and flatter can do, I have no inclination to believe Fanny one of them, or to think that so much tenderness of disposition and so much taste as belonged to her, she could have escaped heart whole from the courtship of such a man as Crawford, in spite of there being some precious ill opinion of him to overcome, and had not her affection been engaged elsewhere. So Jane is literally inserting herself in the conversation and saying that there's literally nobody that could resist Crawford except Fanny because she has affections turned elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's almost not even a matter of does Edmund deserve her? Does she even, it's a matter of, well, it's, she has feelings for him and that's sort of it.
Yeah. One, that is interesting you bring up the, because she does it, she hasn't done it a lot, Jane Austen, putting herself in the story and giving her own voice as a narrator. A perspective. It's usually like limited, slightly omniscient, but not like completely.
Mm-hmm. It's like she's like inserting herself to comment, to point out that this guy is flirting with Fanny and no one would be able to resist him. And Fanny, mm-hmm. even herself, is not almost unable to resist him. And were she not already infatuated with Edmund, she wouldn't have been able to resist at all. Which is just sort of a fascinating, like, insert there, just, like, to remind mm-hmm. us, like, I mean, we'll get to this, but, like, there's a moment where I'm like, I'm shipping this. I'm shipping Henry Crawford and Fanny Price, and what is wrong with me? Because if you had told me when we recorded last that I would be saying this, I would have been flabbergasted. but it's like, Jane knows that, and she's just reminding you that, no, Fanny likes this other guy. Stop it.
Just to go back to the jumping ahead thing, when William appeared, didn't it seem like her idolization and excitement and affection for William did seem almost reminiscent of how she looks at Edmund too?
Oh, I like that. Like the way she looks at her, she's so, I don't know how to say this without being creepy. Like her...
it was a little creepy. It was a little creepy when I read it.
Yeah, she's so in love with her brother that when she says that she has like brotherly affections for Edmund, that's like a hint to us. That Edmund is her true love. I don't know what to say without being creepy.
It is kind of, well, because she gets so little affection in general from those around her. And I'm sure that, like, Edmund and William both in her different relationships with both of them were kind of lifelines. So I can't help but think or feel like she doesn't know how to differentiate the feelings. So maybe one is more romantic with Edmund and one obviously more fraternal with her brother. But because like these were the two only real kindness that she got in the household, I don't mm-hmm. know if she necessarily recognizes a difference. It seems to be she's just connecting to anyone who's just showing her any kindness. And so that just, like, on the one hand, that just makes me really sad for her. But also happy that she had something, but it does like cloud whether or not I think that I really want to see her and Edmund together.
Yeah. I mean, the only point, I guess, in Edmund's favor is, you know, William is this seafaring, glamorous, brave hero out, you know, like on the water. And then you have Edmund who's here. We really get a sense of just how committed he is to being
I just say clergyman.
Clergyman, there we go. And you hear how his daddy, like they point out that Edmund doesn't have to live like on the grounds of the church. He could stay at Mansfield Park in like the luxury and whatever and only like, you know, phone in his sermons, I guess. But he says, no, I need to live, you know, where my congregants, isn't that what they're called? My parsonage is.
Sir Thomas says that he knows that Edmund won't be content living like being a part-time clergyman and just like mm-hmm. giving his sermons for a couple hours a week, and that he will want to live among his parishioners and prove himself by constant attention, their well-wisher and friend.
Yeah, and so Fanny likes that. She's, you know, she clearly is impressed with her brother's like glamorous figure, and then she's impressed with Edmund, you know, really wanting to be a great clergyman. And then you have Henry, who's, you know, he has no job. He's like a wealthy young heir. His work is just entertaining himself and going on like hunts and stuff, which is, you know, fine. But it's not, he's not like an upstanding character in terms of like his career. So when you look at things that Fanny values, the example is her brother, and Edmund is like the closest to that. Like, can you see mm-hmm. Fanny being, you know, an heiress? Like, I can't. Oh, like, God. She needs to be busy and keep busy. And so from that respect, I think Edmund is, you know, cut from the cloth to be her...
Her person.
Her person.
There is a moment where I found sort of annoyingly relatable was when she was such a... We're definitely not doing chronological.
Yeah, I don't know, but I don't care.
But it's okay. It means we get to focus a lot more on Fanny and what she's going through, which, like, it's kind of taken long enough. But there is a moment where she gets invited back for dinner to the parsonage.
Oh, the dinner. Dinner. She got invited to the dinner.
And Sir Thomas at first is just like, that's kind of weird. But because of, like, his growing affection for Fanny, she's growing into a woman and becoming, like, prettier and more noticeable, which is also super creepy. It's just, like, he's even relaxing the whole, like, ideas of propriety and the idea that she should be lesser than his daughters. But Lady Bertram's just like, oh, I don't know if I can, you know, spare her for the night, and asking her husband if she could possibly do without Fanny, which is another weird interaction I do want to talk about. Lady Bertram, put a pin in that one. Fanny kind of doesn't want to go and have dinner with them, and Edmund stands up for her. And when he's just like, hey, you can go. And her automatic response is just like, yay, thanks. And she's like, oh, but I don't want to. She's just such a people pleaser. Her immediate reaction to someone doing any favor to her, regardless of whether she wants it or not, is to be, like, grateful. Mm-hmm. So I think that speaks to, like, just how ingrained that is in her. She wants to be useful and take care of people, even if it's, like, letting them think that they're taking care of her. So, yeah. No, I don't see her at all being the kind of person who could just run in an estate.
No, the whole dinner thing is just so painful. The whole how shocked she is to be invited to dinner. She'd scarcely ever been dined out. And, you know, everyone is, like, trying to stop her from going. Wait, Lady Bertram likes her around because she can, like, make her tea. And then to have Mrs. Norris just, like, literally pick out all of her insecurities, it's horrifying. I hated reading that. And Fanny believes her.
Mrs. Norris is a monster. I know. That's the worst part. It's just the gaslighting that Mrs. Mm-hmm. Norris gets into throughout this entire book. I think you're the one who said, you know, I think she's going to be, like, our funny, terrible character. No, she's just terrible. She's just terrible.
Oh, she's awful.
Yeah, she's like, the only reason why you can go is because we allow it to go. We, as if we're of standing. We, Miss Norris, we, really, we. She's like, or you can only go because I'm going to be very, make the big sacrifice and take care of my sister for you. And then they're letting you go and they're just being nice to you and they don't really want you. It's just that they're such kind people and it's not going to be that great of a dinner anyways. And it gets to the point where she, like, can't even enjoy this one little nice thing that she's allowed herself to enjoy and savor, even a little, because that is so not a thing she does. And I hate it. I hate it so much.
This line here, the nonsense and folly of people stepping out of their rank and trying to appear above themselves. I do beseech and entreat you not to be putting yourself forward and talking and giving your opinion as if you were one of your cousins. Remember, wherever you are, you must be the lowest and last. That's, like, mean. That's cold. That's mean.
Terrible. Ugh. In what world is Fanny the kind of person who's going to put herself forward and be like, so, I have opinions?
I know. And then she's like, and then remember, you're going to have to walk there. And Fanny's like, okay. Like, and she's like, no, you're going to have to walk there. No one's going to call a carriage for you. No one. And so Fanny's like, okay, I have to walk 20 miles or whatever. And then Sir Bertram's like, when should I bring the carriage around for you? And she's like, shocked that you would call the carriage for her.
The timing was wonderful. It was so good. Again, Sir Thomas being really surprising with the, like, I'm sorry, my niece is going to be walking? No, 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 no. My niece is not going to be walking anywhere. There's a lot of carriage drama in this.
Carriage drama. And Fanny, like, leaves because she can't even, like, bear, like, Mrs. Norris to think that she's, like, celebrating her win in any way. It's like, celebrate, Fanny. Like, you won this one.
You did, even if it wasn't you at all. It's just celebrate that someone decided to be a decent human to you.
Oh, wait. And so creepy line, though. Uh-huh. The Edmund line that we were talking about. He goes, now I must look at you, Fanny, said Edmund, with the kind smile of an affectionate brother, and tell you how I like you. And as well as I can judge by this light, you look very nicely indeed. A woman can never be too fine when she's all in white. And then he ruins it. Has not Miss Crawford a gown, the same gown? Edmund.
Oh, my gosh. So many times that Mary and Edmund have found reason to talk about the other person, it's so frustrating. Yeah, that was such a, ooh. You know what? You just brought to mind reading that, it made me think of what's his name? Varys. Is that the boy?
Yeah.
In Game of Thrones in episode one where he's, you know, getting ready to sell his daughter off, or daughter, his sister off for an advantageous marriage in a terrible time. That is just what came to mind.
Oh, gross. Now I'm going to think about that.
I'm so sorry. But if I have to suffer, you must
too. Oh my God. What is his name though? This is going to drive me crazy. Because not Varys. What is it?
Viserys.
Viserys. Okay. I was like.
Varys is the mermaid.
And remember when we used to like love Game of Thrones so much?
Listen, I need to actually read the books and maybe I'll fall in love again. I know.
Yeah, I'm still in love. I just have a like, very selective memory. I'm still in love. I've still got it.
That's the reason I can't go back to it, because I know that I will continue being in love and get hurt again.
That's true. But now you've like ruined the whole Edmund Fanny relationship for me, because I'm just going to picture Daenerys and her creepy brother.
Well, so I do think that Sir Thomas's weird turnaround on Fanny and his affection for her is because she is growing. She's, what, 16 years old, and she's becoming more beautiful, and people are noticing, and he notices that the rich guy is starting to pay attention to her. So it does feel a little bit like he's doing this thing of showing her more affection, not just because, you know, oh, she might be able to get married off and sell the pig off to the highest bidder kind of thing. But he is just generally recognizing, oh, she is an asset of mine, a marriageable asset of mine.
Oh, my God.
Not that I don't think he doesn't enjoy her and is affectionate to her for, like, reasons of her being a human being and also family. But I don't know. Am I just cynical now?
Yes, that, like, hurt myself. That hurt me.
We already know I'm cynical.
We were just talking about how Sir Thomas isn't that bad, and now you've just like, oh, my heart. But you're right. I mean, you are right.
Well, because there was also that moment when Edmund was like, you know, I think my dad would really enjoy if you just like spoke up more. I got really excited when you asked him a question about Antigua, and I kind of wish you would say more. She's just like, yeah, I totally asked him about slave trade, but then I got really embarrassed because no one else is saying anything. And then I remember last time when you were talking about Jane Austen just like slipping in more and more conversation throughout this book about the British slave trade and the landed gentry and other upper class people of England at the time. Basically only profiting because of slavery, which was interesting.
Yeah. But so we have the dinner party, right? And I do want to make a comment here. And Miss Nora says that 5 is the most awkward number for a dinner party. Agree or disagree? Is it 5 or 3?
Oh, I don't know. I've been to third wheel a lot. So sometimes I actually do think. Actually, it might be 5. It might be 5.
It might be 5, right? I was like, Mrs. Norris kind of has a point. Like, I like thought about it for
she
like,
kind of does.
5 is such an awkward number.
Because, like, 3, you can, like, bounce off each other actually pretty well.
That's true.
With 5, it is easier to, like, for everyone to pair up and then to be the one. But fortune favors the awkward. They didn't have to deal with a odd number of 5 because someone has returned. Henry is back.
Henry's back.
Here to ruin lives all over again.
Oh, God. I like Henry now. Like, what is wrong with me?
What the hell? I kind of get why Mary treats him the way she does, because she's just like, you're an idiot. You're an idiot. You're playing with these women's lives. You're messing with them. You're only doing this because you're bored. And at the same time, she's just like, but like, go on, whatever. I obviously love you and I'm just going to let it happen.
Go with me here. So there was a period of time in, I want to say the 90s, when every movie had, you know, like an innocent girl who wore glasses and she's in love with like the hot popular guy. And the hot popular guy like takes a bet from his friends that he can make her, you know, like his prom date or whatever, you know? And then he like starts off with bad intentions, but then as he gets to know her and she takes off her glasses and he realizes how beautiful she is. And then they get in a fight in the last minute because she like finds out about the bet. But in the end, they end up together. And like, this is that. This is that story.
This is 100% that. One of the highest points of cinematic history, personally speaking. I feel like I'm pretty correct on that.
I mean, there's no hacky sack, but...
I mean, it's great because you kind of love the idea of like someone being like, yeah, I'm super cool, but like I see who you are underneath, even though she's not wearing glasses. She's just like...
Shy.
Just generally getting healthier.
Yeah.
And hitting her, like, her stride in puberty. It's weirdly charming how hard he's trying, especially since she's not biting. I mean, she's kind of, like, reluctantly going with it. But it's not affecting her in a way where you're just, like, really worried for her. You're, like, the only person who seems like they can get hurt in this situation right now is Henry, and I'm okay with that.
I the things that he does here, so toxic, but I, like, fall for it every time. The way he, like, turns to her and his voice is softer. The way he's, like, falling in love with her. I'm just, like, I eat it up. This is, like, the shit that I like.
I know. And we both, I noticed that we both highlighted the same part where, you know, he told his sister everything about how she is, you know, so pretty now. And it's, I'm not leaving here until I make her love me. Once William appears, then she's definitely not paying attention to Henry, anything like that. And her happiness has just kind of made her more beautiful. And that he was no longer in doubt of the capabilities of her heart. She had feeling, genuine feeling. It would be something to be loved by such a girl, to excite the first ardors of her young, unsophisticated mind, which is a terrible thing to say.
Oh no, but I love it. Why she
she interested him more than he had foreseen. A fortnight was not enough. His stay became indefinite.
Oh my god. Why do I like that?
I know. You said swoon. I said that's a little hot, except Henry sucks. But he has, like, he's turning around his entire life, his entire schedule to be like, I must have this woman. And he's not, like, demanding it. He's not making, like, overt gestures. He's not trying to, like, get Sir Thomas on his side or, like, get anyone else. He's genuinely trying to, like, turn his her attention and affection to him in ways that on the surface are actually, like, sweet and romantic. I mean, underneath is a bunch of crap that I don't want to address or acknowledge, but, like, he's actually working for it.
Oh, I, like, I'm trying to find the moment. Oh my god. So they're having this conversation in chapter 25, and now I'm just all over the place because I'm like,
who cares?
And they're talking about Southerton is really awkward because remember how terrible Henry was because he was, like, playing the game and he, like, ran off with Mariah and it was very, yes, like, not whatever. And they're, like, telling the story, and he's, like, he's feeling very self-conscious about it. And he leans over and he says, I should be sorry to have my powers of planning judged by that day at Southerton. I see things differently now. Do not think of me as how I appeared then. Like, ugh.
He's trying to change. He doesn't know why. Why are we so hard for me? This?
It's because we're like, sometimes the toxic mess, sometimes...
We love Beauty and the Beast too much as kids. That's what happened.
That's exactly what happened. We were ruined. We were ruined by Disney.
I mean, who hasn't been? There's even a moment, and it is a short-lived moment. It doesn't last, but there is a moment where he actually seems to admire William. I mean, everyone completely respects and admires William, even though he's not a person of means or of upper class or anything like that, or of money even. But when he comes into the room, he has this, like, aura of authority that people are, they just have to give him his attention with everything he's seen and done and the kind of person it's made him. Mm-hmm. Like, they're taken with the stories of heroism and general, like, ability and skill and doing things, which is the very antithesis of what Henry is as a spoiled fuckboy.
I know.
The glory of heroism, of usefulness, of exertion, of endurance made his own habits of selfish indulgence appear in shameful contrast. And he wished he had been a William Price, distinguishing himself and working his way to fortune and consequence with so much self-respect and happy ardor instead of what he was. The wish was rather eager than lasting, which is really funny.
I know. It's a nice little, like, one-liner there.
Yeah. Which is definitely a moment of shade, but...
It's totally a moment of shade, but, like, there's some redeeming of Henry here. Like, every time I want to condemn a character, but yeah, every time every time I want to be like, I don't care for this character, there's, like, a change. I don't know. It keeps, like, flip-flopping for me. And even Fanny is not immune to his charms. She, yeah, like, starts, you know, to think of him as, like, a nice guy.
Mm-hmm. And at some point when they're leaving for dinner, Edmund gets her shawl from the servant, but Henry is somehow a little bit faster, and he's the one who puts it around her shoulders, and she has to, like, because she's nice, she just still rewards him with a smile, and you're like, oh no. Well, because it's so much, I mean, I think part of the appeal is that it is, despite the fact there's so much potential for terribleness to happen to our dear little Fanny, it seems so much more less complicated than her thing with Edmund.
That's
so
true.
It is very appealing.
I mean, I tell you, like, when chapter 24 opens, he goes, no, my plan is to make Fanny Price in love with me. I gasped. I was like, what? You jerk. Like, I was so mad at Henry. But then, like, as the chapters went on, I was like, oh, my God. Like,
Henry,
why do I ship this?
Got.
Yeah. Now he's, like, infatuated with her. Like, it's sort of, like, lovely the way that it happened, even though, obviously, like, it starts, like, horribly.
Yeah. No, there's actually, like, a moment now where I'm kind of wanting everyone to not be with Edmund. Because William comes in, and you can just imagine him. He's probably, like, good-looking, like, a little sea-worn. The hair is kind of swept. Maybe he's got, like, a loose blonde curl that's been, like, gently straightened by the wind a little bit.
Oh, my God, Annie. You're painting a picture for me.
He's got the steadiness. He's got a uniform.
Oh, the uniform. Ugh.
He's got ambition with the support of Sir T. So I'm like, wait a second. Do I want him for Mary now?
Oh my God, I know.
Do I want this to be about the Prices and the Crawfords now?
Okay, so first of all, I thought you were going to say for Fanny, and then I was like, oh yeah, and then I was, no, they're brother and sister.
We established there's a weird thing happening between the two.
But yes, Mary, maybe William and Mary have a thing. Oh God. Mary, forget about Edmund. Let's ship Mary and William and
Mary
Fanny
William.
And Henry.
Yes. And they have somehow both all made everyone better.
This is absolutely not what Jane intended.
This is not what she intended at all, but it is so much fun.
I know we've, like, totally skipped ahead, but I do want to, like, highlight some of the lines in the conversation that Henry and Mary have about, like, this whole scheme, because they're just, like, horribly awful, but also, like, made me laugh. They're, like, having this conversation, and he's like, no, no, she's, like, improved, and Mary's like, there's no tall women to compare her with.
Mary's so funny.
And I love the quote where he says, I mean, he says that, like, the reason that he likes her is because she doesn't like him. And he has this, like, really funny quote. Well, there is this, it is nice because this is where Mary, I can't hate on Mary completely because Mary does value Fanny. She has this line where she says, foolish fellow, and so this is her attraction after all. This is it, not her caring about you. I will not have you plume her deep, for she is good little creature as ever lived and has great deal of feeling. So she does stand up for Fanny and she doesn't say anything. She says it's a little condescending, but it's not like mean. She's like, don't make her fall in love with you. That's like awful. Mm-hmm. And then he says this horrible line that made me laugh so hard, even though it's awful. No, I will not do her harm, dear little soul. I only want her to look kindly on me, to give me smiles as well as blushes, try to keep me longer at Mansfield and feel when I go away and that she will never be happy again and want nothing more. So he starts like, no, I just want like little smiles from her, and then ends with like, I want her to think about me all the time and be sad when I leave.
He's the epitome of the guy of just like, I don't want a relationship, but also low-key I want all the benefits of a relationship without having to put anything into it.
Fuck boy.
Little did he know how unbelievably in love he would fall in love with Fanny. Or at least obsessed. This is really bad.
This is awful. Because this is like the rom-com situation that I'd love. This is like the bad. This is why I'm like, this is why we're bad people.
But, I mean, we just haven't gotten to the end yet. Or really, and because neither of us read this book before, we don't know what the actual end game is. We don't know how we're going to get there. We're only halfway through the book. But I love that this is where we've been put now.
I know. How fun. Like, after the play was over, I'm like, well, what now? But now I'm just, like, super into it. I was like, take off Mariah and Julie from the playboard, the chessboard. And, like, now we have an even more fun situation. Now Henry's in love with Fanny, and Fanny's still in love with Edmund, and Edmund's in love with Mary, and Mary's in love with – I'm into it.
Love triangles are fun and all, but somehow – I mean, I guess this is technically still more love triangles, but there's fewer now on the board. And somehow it's more dramatic without a play.
I know. I love it. It made me really sort of wonder why there hasn't been a modern adaptation of this made, like Clueless or all the other, you know, Shakespeare, but like She's All That, 10 Things I Hate About You. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I feel like this story would, in a way, lend itself very well to like a high school adaptation.
Oh my God, this is so high school.
It's so high school, but then I guess everyone would be rooting for Henry and Henry to end up with, it's like in 16 Candles, where you want her to end up with like the cool popular guy, and she does, but there's that alternate ending where she ends up with her like nerdy friend, Ducky. Mm-hmm. And it's like, and then they did that ending and it didn't test well. So they had to change it to her ending up with not popular.
Oh, yeah. No, in my head, Henry is now Noah Centineo. So.
Oh, my God. Yes. Oh,
I know. No. I'm sorry. That is also your fault because that popped in my head while you were talking. So I'm blaming you.
It's very high school and he's very hot. And now I want Fanny to be with Henry, which is very toxic of me. But I mean, Edmund's not that, I don't know. There's so many things that need to happen. We're only halfway through. You're absolutely right.
The person that Edmund is currently, I mean, he's got the basis of a good person in there. He's got integrity. He's got a very pure feeling for Mary, where he has to interrogate all these things that he believed that he wanted for his future. Great. Cool. But the person that he is right now, and the person that Fanny is right now and was and is becoming, still isn't in the same place that they're not in the place they need to be for each other. So right now where they are in the middle of the book, with admittedly many, many more chapters left to read, it isn't right now, which is cool. It's interesting. It's just a lot of fun that these other characters have appeared, and who they are kind of makes them like really exciting for our main people.
Yeah, it's fascinating, especially when you juxtapose it with, like, I understand that our misconceptions of people like Wickham and of Colonel Brandon and Willoughby and Mr. Darcy, that they change throughout the book. And it's done in a more gradual way. Mm-hmm. This just feels very different from that, because we're just getting very well-rounded, nuanced, sort of shitty, sort of okay people. And that's sort of the way real life works. And it feels less like a story and more that people are messy and there's a lot of gray area. And it's fun to see this side of Jane. And I can see why it's not one of her more famous works, because it's so much more complicated and it's more fun to talk about and unpack. And
I can see how hard it would be to adapt this even to like a more modern story or more of a period piece. It is less clean cut and it is harder to romanticize. So I think that's probably why. But I'm having so much fun with it.
It feels more Shakespearean.
Yes. Like, I could see the sort of comedy of errors type Shakespeare things where it's like all farces and you can, you know, you've seen adaptations with people running in and out of doors and everything. Something kind of on the topic of like nuanced, morally gray characters came up a bit on my other podcast, Still Great Bob, where we're watching, I know. We're watching Mad Men, we being me, Matt, and Melissa, two lovely friends of ours. We got a very lovely email from someone who's talking about, you know, how he wants to talk about how much more interesting the characters are because they are so nuanced, because they are so gray, and how, like, the pitting together the redeeming sides versus the kind of terrible sides where they're terrible people. And a lot of our complaints about it, specifically me and Melissa, are how, like, the men are allowed to have that kind of cyclical nature of being terrible and being good and trying to be better again and, you know, cycling through things again and again, and how the women have to grow and be strong and be amazing and all that stuff. And it's so interesting to compare that show, which is mainly written by male writers and a male showrunner who had accusations of toxic workplace environments and possibly some sexual harassment, versus Jane Austen, who is this very practically minded satirist, but also writing these interesting characters from a female perspective. And everyone gets to be kind of messy and kind of terrible and uncomfortably realistic, but also heroes in their own stories. And I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know where I'm going with this. It's fascinating.
No, I love that discussion. I think that's really, I mean, it's so cool in a way how these different properties made in different times, focusing on different times, written by completely different people of different times, how the stories can be shaped and how they can be compared. And, you know, I always joke that there's basically three stories, like there are five stories in the world, you know, like there are only like a few amount of stories, but it's like how they're told, what perspectives you use, who's telling the stories. And it's why I'll never get tired of reading stories about there only being one bed, you know, because it's like it's everyone will bring a different perspective to it. And it's why I love reading. It's why I love movies and television and art, because everyone's perspective is different and they bring different things to different properties and their stuff. And that's why it's so fun to talk about them and to unpack them, because you get to bring your perspective into it and interrogate, you know, why did they write this? You know, is Mary Crawford being annoying here because she wants, you know, Edmund to have a lot of money? Like, on one hand, yeah, she's being annoying. Like, just let him live his life. But on the other hand, she's a woman in this time, written by a woman in this time, and you're in that time, the only way women could have power is if they married someone who had money. And so is Mary to blame for being in her way about this? You know, we can judge her, but then we also have to consider, you know, we also have to consider women in that time mm-hmm. and the perspective that Jane's writing from. So it really just enhances the nuance and makes a better story.
I love that, by the way. It is super cool because on the discussion of like unlikable characters, one that is like a whole other discussion about how quite often like you have your strong female character and she always has to be like strong and badass, and sassy mouth and all those things, which is a character that actually does come up in Jane Austen and something that she is like stereotyped for. But then we have Edmund as a alleged love interest, and he's morally right, and he does take care of Fanny, and in a lot of ways he is a hero to her, but he is kind of sanctimonious and paternalistic and in love with someone else. And he's not necessarily a bad person, but there's something about it that's just really off-putting and a little unlikable in that way. And then you have Fanny, who is ostensibly our heroine of the story, but she's weak and deferring and she is fragile and she's always constantly making herself as small as possible. And who wants to relate to that? Unfortunately, I do relate to that. And that's why I dislike her sometimes. But to see the journey that she goes through and to become more of an active participant in her own story is... Oh, it's just so, it's so exciting to be, and I know we take so much time to go through all of it. It's so exciting, though, to get to see that and then have these people come into her lives who you think are one thing, and they are not those people, but they're also something more, and they're not static, and I love stories. Stories are great.
Oh, hot take. You're making me emotional, man. All right, so, okay, do we have any, do you have any burns, or did we decide to call the shade corner?
We're throwing shade, Austen shade throwing, I guess. Yeah. There was, I think the moment, a few of them already got mentioned just because they were such good moments. Like at the beginning when they were talking about how somber and grave things were at the Mansfield Park, now that Sir Thomas is back, you know, how there was never much laughing in his presence and all that terrible stuff. There was when the Bertram men were going to go to Southerton to hang out with the Rushworths, and how this the possibly the most unkind thing that Edmund has ever said when he's talking about how much Sir Thomas liked Rushworth and they're going to spend time together, you know, that he must like him less after tomorrow's visit, for we shall be 5 hours in his company. I should dread the stupidity of the day. If there were not a much greater evil to follow, the impression it must leave on Sir Thomas. He cannot much longer deceive himself. I am sorry for them all, and would give something that Rushworth and Maria had never met.
Some Edmund shade there. I like it.
He is the man who brought us that phrase. You mentioned, you know, how Fanny had missed the sisters, you know, with a degree of affectionate regret, which they have never done much to deserve. I feel like I had a few more. Oh, I feel like we just need to not ever talk about Miss Norris. She makes me so angry. But so cruel.
So casually cruel, as Taylor Swift would say.
And with so much to say on anything. There's a moment at the wedding where she, you know, tried to cry. Or when she was telling Fanny about how grateful she should be and not, you know, put herself above her station at dinner, Mrs. Norris fetched breath and went on again. And in another large paragraph. There was something else that she said that really got to me. I don't know if you can really call it throwing shade, but Mary just telling Henry how he's a terrible person for trying to go after Fanny. If you do set about a flirtation with her, you will never persuade me it is in compliment to her beauty or that it proceeds from anything but your idleness and folly.
I can't wait. That's one scene I can't wait to see performed in an adaptation. I just think it'd be really funny.
It's going to be so good. And like, I can see a lot of affection in that moment too, which is going to add to it.
Yeah, you don't get the sense that she's like actually, you know, calling him like calling him names or anything. Like, it's more just like sibling banter.
Yeah. Where, because you're just like, this is the part, someone that you really, you know, the same kind of affection probably that Fanny has for William, I'm sure Mary has similar to Henry, even though he's terrible. Oh, when William arrives, it's actually with very little fanfare, and Fanny gets to like have a moment of just like greeting her brother without any interruption or anything, and they make mention that Edmund and Sir Thomas specifically told Mrs. Norris not to interrupt them. Oh, that's funny. That's kind of shady.
That is funny. That is kind of a lovely moment, even if it's because Mrs. Norris wasn't there.
Oh, she's such a jerk. Oh, and there... I know I said we shouldn't talk about Miss Norris, and this isn't necessarily a shade thing, but there was a moment when everyone is at dinner at the parsonage, and Mrs. Norris is just like, okay, well, you know, Fanny, the carriage is here. Fanny just didn't hear that it had arrived. And she's like, we have to go. You have to think about the coachman, as if Fanny is ever not thinking about literally everyone else's comfort over her own. And Mrs. Norris is just like, Sir Thomas, we've arranged that the carriage will come back for you and the other men, and it'll drop us ladies off first. And Sir Thomas is just like, yeah, I know. I told you that was the plan. He's like, never mind. Whatever. You can, whatever. Sorry, I went on for a bit. Do you have any shady moments?
I just have one, and it's my favorite. They're talking about the wedding with Mariah. Mariah's wedding to Rushworth, and the description is, it was a very proper wedding. The bride was elegantly dressed. The two bridesmaids were duly inferior.
Oh.
Listen, I get it. You don't want a Pippa Middleton at your wedding. You just don't.
It's your day.
If Mariah should be the most beautiful on her day as the bride.
Especially if she's marrying some guy she doesn't really like, out of spite, basically.
Yeah, let her have her moment. I'm fine with it.
Because it's slightly downhill from here.
I mean, they're in Brighton, so they can go catch some officers or whatever.
Oh, in Brighton. What will happen with Julia? Oh, yeah, we still have to worry about Julia. Anyways.
Maybe this is like an expanded universe. Like maybe Julia flirted with Wickham, but then he ended up picking Lydia. Like maybe they knew Lydia Bennett. I don't know. I'm just workshopping here.
Maybe. Oh, speaking of expanded universes, I think at some point we mentioned, like, wouldn't it have been interesting to hear the story, you know, to get the story of the original sisters, Lady Bertram, Mrs. Norris, and Mrs. Price.
Yeah.
Considering how much we dislike Mrs. Norris now, is this something you would still want to hear?
Why, do you know that it exists or something? Is this like a trick question?
No. I'm just curious because I'm like, Lady Bertram's kind of terrible, but in the exact opposite way that Mrs. Norris is.
That's true. I mean, I would read a story about the sisters. I mean, maybe there's a fanfic out there. I personally would never write Regency era fanfic because I don't have time to do enough research to make it historically accurate, and that would bother me.
I feel like the Mrs. Price's would have been the most romantic and sexy.
That's true. But then we wouldn't get all this, like, nuance or whatever that we said we liked.
True. I think that would be another, like, Cinderella evil stepsisters and Cinderella situation, though.
Oh, that's true. We have talked about Fanny's situation sort of being, like, a Cinderella situation.
Mm-hmm. So now I'm just kind of like, I wonder if there would be some parallels there. But
oh, there definitely would be, for sure.
I just kind of hate the idea of, like, having to deal with more Mrs. Norris than I really want to.
Yeah, I don't really need, like, the Disney origin story of Mrs. Norris, like, why she is the way she is. Like, I'm fine with her just being awful and me calling her awful. I don't need any anti-hero nonsense.
I'm down with that. I'm not saying I'm going to check AO3 later, but...
Please do. If you do, let me know.
I might. So anyways... Wow.
That was a good episode, if I do say so myself.
So much fun to talk about.
Is there anything more you want to say about these chapters before we wrap it up?
Oh, I mean, probably, but I think that's a pretty good place left out. I don't think we covered everything that I expected us to, but there was so much good to take out of all of it. I'm so excited. I'm so excited to keep going on this with you.
I know, me too. Halfway through Mansfield Park. And I'm very much excited and enjoying this. And I know that when we started, we were like, ugh, Mansfield Park.
I know, especially the first couple of chapters are very, like, dense. They were kind of a slog.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But worth it.
Yeah, so next time chapters 26 to 30, I think, if I did my counting of my fingers math right.
Yeah, we'll see what happens then. Jesse, where can people find us if they want to talk to us? Please talk to us.
Yes, please talk to us. Please rate and review us, 5 stars only. And we'd love to hear from you. You can find us at our website, thedailynightly.com. You can find us on Twitter at nightlypod, on Instagram at thedailynightly. And please email us at thedailynightly@gmail.com. Oh, also, I have a book Instagram that you can...
Yes! Jesse, tell me about your Bookstagram.
Yes, so I'm trying to be famous on Bookstagram, and it's not going super well, so please find me, and you can hear about all the books that I'm reading in real time. My Instagram handle is bookjessieisbetter, so look me up, talk about books with me. It's going to be a lot of fun.
I've been really loving the reviews. So
thank you. You know, nobody actually writes reviews on Bookstagram. They just take pretty pictures and then like ask you questions about like your day and stuff. But like, I'm giving you the review content that you're asking for or not asking for.
they're fabulous and I highly recommend it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Whew. Until next time, maybe Jesse and I will have this much caffeine next time too.
I know. I'm feeling really good. I can like go run laps.
Until next time, guys.
Yes. Happy reading.
Happy reading.